Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we talk about on this show. We talk about plans and strategies. I tell stories, share some of my big epic fails that I made in the past and that, quite honestly, I still make. Sometimes I interview people. You get the idea. It's a little bit of everything. And we're actually going to be starting a series on the idea of empowering students with voice and choice. And in order to get there, I want to talk about the why of student ownership and empowerment. And today, I want to talk about something pretty current, something that a lot of folks are talking about, and it's this idea of learning loss. And I kind of have a different idea on learning loss. I'm not terribly concerned about this whole experience of learning loss, and I want to explain why. So all three of my kids have missed a significant number of days because of the need to quarantine. The Omicron variant is sweeping through our neighborhoods, and our local school district recently created a no-contact day this last Friday. Many caregivers and community members are concerned about learning loss with the missed days, and they're worried about this on top of the feeling that virtual learning didn't go great last year. A friend of mine said, "I feel like my daughter is falling behind academically, and I don't even know how to help her." I've heard similar sentiments at the university level as professors have shared some of their concerns about the incoming freshmen who seem to lack some of the prerequisite knowledge that they'll need in order to access the higher level, you know, academic, university level content. And yet, I'm not terribly concerned about learning loss. Don't get me wrong. I think learning loss is real, and I think it's something that we need to address. But when I visit classrooms, or when I work with the teachers in my cohort, I see bigger concerns than learning loss. Often, the biggest issue seems to be the lack of soft skills. Either that or the absence of student self-direction or the feeling that students just aren't engaging very much or just the notion that student behavior seems to be kind of out of control this year. So I want to explore this idea that maybe something else might be bigger than learning loss. The other idea I want to share is the notion that speed might actually be a little bit overrated in learning. And I want to examine how things like soft skills and stickiness and play and self-direction might actually help students prepare for this unpredictable world where they're going to inhabit. In other words, I get it, learning loss is real and significant, and we don't want to ignore it. But at the same time, the bigger question of what are we preparing students for involves this sense of uncertainty. And that requires more than just mastering a curriculum map. Speed isn't everything. As a student, I hated math because I was really, really slow at it. To this day, I still struggle with computational fluency. I mean, it's something that I deal with on a regular basis. It takes me longer than most people to do math in my head. I know it. I can see it when I interact with others. I second guess myself when I'm engaging in basic multiplication and division. I'm not a typical, quote, numbers person. I struggle with memorizing dates, and I often transpose numbers when I have to remember a string of them. I had a hard time memorizing my social security number, and I haven't memorized my account numbers for my bank accounts, and it takes me a little bit of second guessing to just remember my license plate number. Two-factor authorization has been a complete nightmare for me, and we have to go through that every probably 4 days or so at work, getting a text and then typing the number into the authorization code. Now, I have every reason to hate math, but I don't. I actually love math, precisely because I am so slow at it. I can meander. I can ask tons of questions with data. I can play around with math. As a child, I felt a sense of dread when I would have to do those timed tests. I'd start sweating the moment that the teacher passed by with the handouts with all those boxes on them. Years later, I have all the time in the world, and I can treat math like a long hike or a breezy drive in the summer. I love math. Battling against my own math anxiety was tough, but coming through it, I think it has made me more curious and probably a little more humble with numbers and data. I can second guess myself more easily, and it's just a habit that I've developed. Being less sure that I have the right answers helped me find trends in a data set that I might not have easily noticed initially. I struggled with advanced statistics in college, but that struggle kept me focused and it made me more curious. I developed a mindset of slower thinking that allowed me to catch some critical, unexpected insights in my doctoral research on project-based learning and teacher motivation. By contrast, I was a fast reader as a kid, with a really high comprehension level as a student. Even now, when I listen to an audiobook, my natural inclination is to push that sucker up to 1.5 speed. If you are listening to this podcast and you are at 1.5 speed, you might be just like me. But if I'm not careful, I will sprint my way through reading. Speed has served me well. I can consume and retain significant amounts of written information. I can wrestle with big ideas really quickly. But sometimes speed has actually backfired. If I'm not careful, I will miss some critical details. I move into autopilot and stop thinking critically about a particular passage or line of thought. In school, I internalized the message that being good at a subject was about speed and accuracy, which is really sort of the idea of fluency. But I missed the reality that mastering a subject is also about slower, deeper work with more experimental attempts. In other words, being slow has its advantage. The need for slower thinking. While it's hard to predict the future, many of our students will need to engage in deeper, slower work. They will work on projects that take weeks or even months to accomplish. They'll need to find unique solutions that require divergent thinking. And the truth is, computers do an amazing job when it comes to quickly analyzing data and running through tasks more accurately. Meanwhile, the human mind, while slower than the computer, is able to think creatively. We can dream up new possibilities and engage in functional novelty that artificial intelligence still struggles to attain. We can move beyond pre-programmed tasks and into a place where we see things differently. So what does that mean? It means that if students are going to engage in complex creative thinking, they will need to have longer, slower, sustained moments of deep focus. Deep work is especially relevant in a distracted world where we can get sucked into smaller tasks that divert our attention. We live in a world of instant media where we are constantly pinging back and forth between devices. But the truth is, if we want students to become makers and philosophers and researchers, they need to have the mental endurance to stick with longer-term tasks, even if that work is slower. This is a concept that Cal Newport refers to as deep work in his landmark book of the same name. It's what happens when you delve into meaningful, sustained work that requires full cognitive attention. Newport argues that the constant interruptions of email and social media reduce our attention while increasing our cognitive load. This ultimately reduces our ability to get into that place of deep work. And deep work allows us to get into that place of flow, right? Where time seems to slow down and where the challenge is matching the skill and we just go for hours at the same task, enjoying it, loving it, but also reaching our optimal level of creativity. In other words, while the system continues to value speed and accuracy, our students will often need to do work that involves slowing down, thinking outside the box, experimenting and persevering. If AI is the proverbial hare, our students will need to succeed at being really good tortoises. Content still matters. While learning is about more than just speed and accuracy, our content still makes a difference. We need students to learn how to read and write. We need them to learn how to think like scientists and historians and mathematicians and artists and musicians, and you get the idea. We all have curriculum maps to follow and standards that we have to teach. The truth is that learning loss is real, and we can't pretend that it doesn't matter. But I think it can help to ask the question, what do students need in the long run? It allows us to reframe it a bit instead of focusing entirely on single learning standards or benchmark test results. In other words, yes, learning loss is real, but the bigger question is, what is the ultimate goal of learning? And are students losing that? You can kind of think about it this way. If the goal is curiosity or creativity, and they lose that sense of wonder while they're at school, I'd argue that that is a bigger learning loss than the failure to factor polynomials. If it's to prepare students for the future, we need to recognize that our future is wildly unpredictable. The last 2 years has taught us that, and our curriculum maps alone won't get students to where they need to be. Many districts have developed graduate profiles that center on bigger, lifelong, essential skills. I've had the honor of working with some of these districts, actually several different districts in the last couple of years, who are asking, what does it mean to teach the standards while developing these key skills? Instead of focusing solely on learning loss, the focus is on helping students develop those key soft skills while also mastering the standards where they might be falling behind. So if that's the case, what does it mean to teach the content in a way that allows them to develop those soft skills? The following are some of the questions you might ask as you consider both the curriculum and the graduate profile that you've developed. Question number one, is the curriculum sticky? When we think about learning loss, it's easy to imagine a place where students are supposed to be and contrast that with their current knowledge in the moment. But learning loss also occurs when students learn a topic in a shallow way and then forget it later. Ever crammed for a test and then discovered that you forgot all the information 2 weeks later? This type of learning loss is more like a learning evaporation, right? It's the notion that the learning wasn't truly sticky to begin with. This stickiness factor is critical because so many of the standards build on each other from year to year. If you take the time to explore math or reading standards, for example, you'll see significant overlap between third grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade on the U.S. Common Core standards. If you're not from the U.S., I apologize. Your standards might be laid out differently, but there is this sense of spiraling back to what they learned the year before, but learning it at a deeper level. Similarly, the big concepts in science tend to cycle from year to year, with students learning a topic like forces in motion at a deeper level every time they learn it. Unfortunately, when learning isn't sticky, teachers spend more time reviewing previous content and reteaching the previous skills. One of the challenges with this year's learning loss is not so much that students have fell behind with instructional time, so much as they've forgotten content that they learned, say, 2 years ago. We are feeling the lack of stickiness right now. Now, one of the things I love about project-based learning is that it allows for more stickiness. The PBL approach can feel risky. With students lagging behind, it can feel like there's not enough time to engage in authentic PBL. However, there is some fascinating emerging research on project-based learning showing that it not only increases student achievement, but it also allows the learning to remain, to essentially be sticky for a longer amount of time. Unfortunately, many of the students who fall behind in basic skills end up with remediation through repetitive worksheets or drill and kill adaptive learning programs But authentic PBL can be designed with scaffolds and supports in mind so that students learn and remember the content so that they can retain it for a longer period of time. Right, question number two, is there a chance to play? In The Dawn of Everything, David Graeber and David Wingrow argue that the biggest innovations in farming actually occurred through an experimental approach to play farming, where women, and it was predominantly women, adapted new techniques through a bold process of trial and error. In other words, the agricultural revolution wasn't something that was hierarchical and top-down, as many people had supposed it was. It actually went alongside hunter-gathering for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. They go on to describe how some of the biggest innovations in history over the last few millennia actually came from the result of play rather than focused problem-solving. Take, for example, the way that gunpowder was used for celebrations, but not necessarily for military use. In other words, people chased their curiosity and they played with materials and ideas and approaches and only later found how that would solve a problem. Similarly, in the book Thinking Better, Marcus du Sautoy describes how some of the key innovations in mathematics occur when people play with numbers and geometry in creative ways. In education, Jed Derryberry and Julie P. Jones describe how a playful approach to learning can benefit students in classroom settings everywhere by increasing curiosity, fostering collaboration, boosting creativity, a lot of the things that you see with, well, project-based learning. In their book, The Playful Classroom, they describe specific strategies teachers can use to integrate play into the daily classroom experience. For a deeper dive on this, there's an interview that I did with Jed Derryberry about a year ago last year. It's one of my favorite interviews that I did. Go check it out. But if you're thinking that this seems unrealistic, if it seems fanciful, I get it. Teachers have to teach the standards. They have to stick to the curriculum. But playful learning isn't about abandoning the curriculum map in order to pursue free time. Instead, it's about taking a playful approach that incorporates novelty and curiosity and creativity. It includes being a curator and nerding out on your favorite books. It's about thinking divergently or creating something new. In other words, it's less about what and more about how. I'll admit that I used to view playfulness as being, well, kind of childish. While I incorporated playful learning in my middle school classroom, I couldn't imagine it working at the high school level. Then I visited Lan Nguyen's advanced calculus classroom in Winnipeg. His class looked nothing like I would imagine AP classrooms were supposed to look like. The walls were whiteboards and students were working collaboratively at solving problems. They had class celebrations and rituals. He had gamified a few components while still focusing on the intrinsic element. And I love the way he phrased it. He said, "I want students to know that math is fun. I want them to fall in love with math. I want them to treat math like a playground." Lam students still had to master the same standards, and they regularly outperformed more traditional classrooms. These playful elements were not an escape from learning, but an escape to learning. When students realized that they could play with math, they became less anxious. They took more intellectual risks. They pushed through the challenges and developed a growth mindset. Along the way, they developed critical soft skills, which leads to point number three, or I should say question number three, does it develop soft skills? When I visit classrooms or interact with students in my cohort, they describe a similar scenario of students who seem to lack essential soft skills. A first grade teacher said they're struggling with reading, but the bigger struggle is how to deal with some of the violent outbursts we're seeing. A ninth grade teacher said my students aren't turning in their work, which I can handle, but they also give up so easily. They're just not resilient. Some of the issues seem to be related to trauma. No doubt many of these issues are also connected to larger cultural trends that we can't ignore. But the overall theme seems to be that students are genuinely struggling at the social emotional level. They need critical soft skills. This, again, is one of the reasons I love project-based learning. It's a chance for students to develop those critical soft skills like collaboration, creativity, perseverance, in a way that aligns with the learning. In other words, PBL and SEL aren't treated as two separate things. They're treated as something that overlap. In their upcoming book, The Pulse of PBL, Mike Cackley and Matinga Ragatz demonstrate how this overlap of PBL and SEL can help students develop those essential skills. For a deeper dive, check out Mike's great blog post, 10 Ways to Introduce SEL and PBL. I'm a huge fan of Mike Cackley's work. Years ago, Mike helped me revamp my PBL by incorporating SEL soft skills, skill development into our protocols that we were using. And it made it so much better. That's why, as the co-owner of Blend Education Publishing, I jumped at the opportunity to publish their book. So I'm just telling you ahead of time, give a shout out to Mike Cackley and Matinga Ragatz. We'll be interviewing them later on this podcast in a future date. I'm a huge fan of this idea of the overlap of PBL and SEL. Note that PBL and SEL are not new things that you need to add to your already crowded plate. Instead, it's about rearranging your plate in a way that allows students to engage in meaningful soft skills while also engaging in project-based learning. In other words, they get to master the standards through the project, but it's infused with these elements of PBL. So they're gaining the soft skills through the project instead of just learning about the soft skills. We can integrate social-emotional learning into our PBL units in a way that helps facilitate this metacognition. Meanwhile, students can practice those key SEL skills as they engage in PBL. Ultimately, both PBL and SEL can work in tandem, so students develop those critical soft skills and become critical lifelong learners. They develop that creativity, that critical thinking, all those things we want them to have. But this needs to focus on student voice and choice. When this happens, students become more self-directed. So question number four is, does your curriculum empower students with voice and choice? When students are self-directed, they're self-starters, meaning they can initiate learning on their own. They can also problem solve challenges over time. You can imagine it as this overlap, this Venn diagram with being a self-manager on one side, being a self-starter on the other side, and self-direction is that overlap between the two. Now, there's a lot of different ways we can get there, where we can build self-direction into it. But I would argue that when they become self-directed learners, that's when they become the lifelong learners, where they can then bridge whatever learning gap they're experiencing. I'll give a small example. If you think about the launch process that I helped design with my good friend AJ Giuliani, students get to own every phase of this process. Look, listen, and learn. It's their empathy. You know, you might present the idea of the project to them, but they're building on their empathy. During Ask Tons of Questions, they're asking the questions. Understand the process or problem, they own the research process. Navigate Ideas, they're generating their own original ideas. They are ideating on their own. That helps avoid kind of the recipe-based projects that sometimes happen. During the prototyping phase, they own the project management process. They choose the approaches, the style, they might select the materials that go into it. During highlight and fix phase, they own the assessment process, whether it's self-assessment or peer assessment. So every part of it, there is student ownership. Now, I want to point out that even when this is the case, you still have a vital role, right? You are helping design those projects for students. You are building creative limitations for them so that they can work within the creative constraint and engage in that divergent thinking. You are presenting protocols that they can use as they work. You might be incorporating some direct instruction. You might be adding scaffolds for them. So it's not like you stand back and everything is just directed by the students. Self-direction still involves a significant amount of teacher input. But the idea is this, that when we empower students to own the whole process, we increase student buy-in. Students who might initially seem needy become confident as they internalize the reality that they are no longer working for their teachers. Note that we still have to have those structures and protocols, but the goal is for them to become independent learners. Ultimately, it's this idea right here. The best way to prepare students for the future is by empowering them in the present. And when that happens, they can handle anything in an unpredictable world. There are many different ways that we can empower students with voice and choice. So we're going to be getting into this in this upcoming series. This is kind of the introduction to this series. But the bottom line is, when we think about this idea of learning loss, I am more concerned about students losing a passion for learning, or students losing that sense of wonder that they have. Ultimately, yes, we need to teach the standards and the content, but that means nothing if they don't develop those critical, vital, lifelong skills to be able to navigate an unpredictable world. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this, would you do two things? Would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? And would you tell a friend about this? Word of mouth is still one of the best ways to get the word out. So again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.